You're listening to an audio sermon from Hope Bible Church in Oakville, Ontario. For more information, please visit our website at hopeoakville.ca.
Well, good morning, church family. As you just saw in the video, we're going to be looking at the story of Rahab this morning. I bet if you've been following along in our summer series, most of you probably didn't pick Rahab as the next person we were going to be looking at, but I'm excited to get into God's word together so you can open up your Bibles to Joshua chapter 2. That's where we will be today, Joshua 2. And as you're getting there, I actually want to begin with a New Testament reference about Rahab. There's three places in the New Testament that specifically mention Rahab by name, and one of them is Hebrews 11. Now, most of you Bible nerds in here, you will know that Hebrews 11 is what's known as the Hall of Faith. The Hall of Faith, because in Hebrews chapter 11, the author is just going through character after character in the Old Testament and saying that how they demonstrated their faith. By faith, Abraham, and by faith, Isaac, and by faith, Jacob, and by faith, Noah. And then we see here in verse 31 of Hebrews chapter 11 on the screen, he says this: by faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spy. So here's the question. Here's the question. How does a pagan prostitute get placed into the Hall of Faith right next to people like Abraham and Moses and David? Like isn't that scandalous? How does that happen? Like, if you're just doing what the author of Hebrews is doing, you're going mentally in your mind, like, hey, well, who are some of the giants of the Old Testament? And you're thinking, you know what? Noah, that ark was awesome. And you're thinking Moses, man, he split the Red Sea. And you're thinking David, he slayed the giant. And then, you know what? Rahab the prostitute. Let's throw her in there. And yet, here's what we learn. Why does she make it into the Hall of Faith? Because God delights to save those who turn to him in faith. Rahab was the most unlikely person to have faith in God, but we serve an unstoppable God. That's our title for today. Unlikely faith, unstoppable God. So just before we dive into our passage for today, let me summarize the context. Think about the grand narrative here. The Israelites, they were slaves in Egypt for 400 years. God, through Moses, frees them from slavery, gets through the Red Sea, and God says, hey, I got a promised land for you. So Moses sends 12 spies into the promised land to go and check it out. And all but two of those spies, they come back and they're afraid. They're lacking faith to enter the promised land. God just got them through the Red Sea, but they lack the faith to enter the promised land. All but two spies, Caleb and Joshua. And so because they lack faith to continue following God in this, God sends them into the wilderness to wander for 40 years. That generation is gone. The next generation comes up. And this time it's Joshua who's leading the Israelites. And it's time to try again. And so they're gonna go back now into the promised land. And so Joshua now sends two spies into Jericho, which would have been a strategic point of entry into the promised land. And these two spies, they head into Jericho and they walk into the house of Rahab. Why would these two spies enter a house of a prostitute? Because where do you go to try and sneak around a city? You stay at a place where it's common for strangers to be constantly coming and going. Turns out these spies, they weren't that sneaky though, because the king of Jericho finds out and he sends some of his men to go into Rahab's house to go and get the spies. Rahab tricks them. So the king's men, they come on into Rahab's house. Rahab says, yeah, these spies were here, but they left the city, out the city gates, and you gotta go now, because if you don't leave now, you're not gonna catch them. King's men are like, okay. And so they head out and they follow out the city gates and they start chasing after the spies, who meanwhile they are hiding on Rahab's roof under some stalks of flax. Why would Rahab, the shady lady from Jericho, hide Israelite spies? Well, let's read our text together and we'll find out together. Read with me Joshua chapter 2, starting in verse 8. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. There is no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God, in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. And the men said to her, our life for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us this land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. The author of Joshua, when he wrote Joshua chapter 2, he's specifically trying to draw your attention to these seven verses we just read. That's why he places them in the middle of the chapter. In many ways, this serves as Rahab's statement of faith. Rahab's statement of faith. So why does Rahab get placed in the hall of faith? Because God delights to save those who turn to him in faith. Now, if you're anything like me, sometimes you use a word so many times that it begins to lose its meaning. And sometimes I feel like in Christian circles, the word faith can feel like that. And so what we're going to learn here in these seven verses is a little bit about what faith actually means. We're going to see three elements or three aspects of faith that we see in Rahab. And so let's read together again. Just come back to verse 8 with me. It says, before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord, don't miss capital L-O-R-D there. That is the personal covenant-keeping name of the God of Israel. That's Yahweh. That's not any other God but the God of Israel. I know the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. So the first aspect or the first element of faith that we see in Rahab here is this. Faith trusts in God's sovereignty. Notice the first few words here that Rahab says. She says, I know that the Lord has given you the land. It's a statement of sovereignty. Like, your God, the God of Israel, if he wants the land, man, he is going to get the land. There's nothing that anyone can do about it. She says, I know. Ironically, Rahab has more faith in Yahweh than the 10 spies that Moses sent out 40 years earlier. And notice what this trust in God's sovereignty is based in. Like, how did Rahab come to this conclusion that Yahweh is sovereign? Verse 10, she says, we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea. All the inhabitants of the land, man, they melt away before you. So all of Jericho is terrified of Israel because they know what Israel's God did for them 40 years ago. But because 40 years ago, Israel lacked the faith, they delayed the good thing that God was doing. Isn't it funny how we can delay the good thing that God is doing because we lack the faith to go where he's taking us? How many blessings have I forfeited or delayed because I lack the faith to take that step that God was asking me to take? Rahab, in contrast, she trusts God's sovereignty. And how does she do that? She looks at God's track record. She looks at God's track record. A God that can make dry land through the Red Sea, that's sovereignty. She looks back at what God has done and concludes, this God is sovereign. Faith in God's sovereignty increases when we look at God's track record. And so as I was preparing this message this week, I really felt prompted, like, I'm gonna do the same. I'm gonna look at God's track record in my life. And so I took a pen and a journal. I just began to write all of the ways that I've seen God's sovereignty in my own life. And let me just say, if you wanna see your faith increase this week, you should try that exercise. And you just begin to write out all the ways. And one of the first things I wrote down, I just wanted to share with you today. If you were around this church in March and April, you may have seen me walking around on crutches, and I wanted to just tell you a little bit about how I saw God's sovereignty in that. So March 11th, it was a Wednesday, and it was a weird day. That's like the best way I can describe it. I don't know, sometimes you have these days where you just feel like a spiritual heaviness on you. I just constantly felt my neediness, constantly felt the need to pray. And so in the middle of this Wednesday, I text my wife, I said, "Hey babe, we gotta pray tonight. We gotta pray tonight." And so we did that. We started praying together, and we were in a season of like, there was two things in particular that we were praying through, like wrestling with God with. Just seemed like we weren't getting answers to these things. And I remember in the midst of our prayers, my wife said a couple things. My wife said, "God, would you help Owen to slow down? And would you give him some sweet time with you?" The next morning, Thursday, 6 a.m., I'm in the gym doing a movement I've done 1,000 times. My knee snaps. I'm screaming on the floor. I know what happened right away. We call an ambulance. We get into the hospital. They do the ultrasound. They scan it. It's a complete tear of the patellar tendon. No function of the leg. They got me in for surgery 3 days later. So I learned my lesson and I stopped praying with my wife. No, that's not it. That's not it. That's not the lesson here. That's not the lesson here. Over the next few weeks, I slowed down and I had some of the sweetest times with God that I had in a long time. Not only that, but like I experienced God's love in a way that I can't describe. I can't even describe it to you. And those two things that we were wrestling with the Lord with, a few weeks later, they were answered on the same day in a way that I don't think they could have been answered if it wasn't for the injury. What's the point? Why am I saying this? Because whether it's good or whether it's bad, God is up to something. God is sovereign. Yes. God is sovereign. God's sovereignty does not mean that nothing bad is ever gonna happen to you. What it does mean is that no matter what happens, you can have faith that God is up to something, that God is doing something, that he works all things for the good of his people and for his glory, because he knows best in his way and in his timing, often not the way that we would choose or the way that we want, because only he is sovereign, only he sees the whole picture, because only God is sovereign. One of my favorite verses, like what does this mean for you and I? What does this mean for us? On the screen here, Ephesians chapter 2. We are his workmanship. That's literally translated masterpiece. You and I are God's handiwork, are his masterpiece, created in Christ Jesus for good works. Listen, you are not saved by good works, but you are saved for good works. That on the other side of salvation, God has prepared something, which God, listen, prepared beforehand, before you were even a thought in your parents' mind, God prepared something for you that we should walk in them. That we should walk in them. That before the beginning of time, God knew where he was going to place you, when he was going to place you. It's not an accident you were born, when you were born or where you were born or in the family you were born into. It's no accident that you are in the school you're at right now or at the workplace that you're at or in the friend groups that you're in. It's no accident, but under God's sovereignty, he intentionally made you to be living today in August of 2026 here in Hope Oakville, sitting in this chair. He wanted you here in this building today. You are surrounded by the sovereignty and purposes of God. So are you trusting the sovereignty of God or are you fighting it? Trusting the sovereignty of God means you're looking everywhere for God's fingerprints. You're walking into a room, you're asking the question like, God, what are you doing here? It's one of my favorite questions as I've grown in faith in God. One of the questions I've tried to start asking is, instead of like fighting it, I'm just kind of trying to start asking myself the question, God, what is it that you're doing here? Like, what is it that you've placed me here for in this time, in this season? And we can sometimes be so future-oriented that we forget even what God is doing here and now, whether we want to be in the season we're in or not. God is sovereign and he is doing something. So we ask ourselves the question, like, God, who is the person you want me to share you with today? Who is the person that you want me to encourage? What is the assignment that you have given me? What are the good works that you prepared beforehand for me today? Faith, trust in God's sovereignty. Keep reading with me now. Look again at verse 10. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. Verse 11. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. And there is no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God, in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. The next element of faith that we see in Rahab is this: faith declares God's supremacy. Faith declares God's supremacy. The city of Jericho at this time, it would have been filled with polytheistic idol worship. That just means they worship many different false gods. And this religious nature was heavily interwoven in their culture, in their politics, into everything else. It was the air that they breathed. And then Rahab, in the midst of it, declares, Yahweh, your God, he is God in the heavens and the earth. Hey, she's not saying here, your God is like one of all of them. Like, it's not like, you know, you got Baal, and then you got Ma, and then you got Yahweh. No. She's saying, your God, no rivals. Your God is God. And in fact, all of Jericho is trembling in the fear of the power of Israel's God. Rahab says, our hearts melted, and there is no spirit left in any man. You know what I thought about this week as I was reading that verse? I thought, man, VeggieTales lied to us. Okay, so I don't know if you remember that kid's cartoon where there's that Jericho episode, and there's these like French peas on top of the Jericho wall, and they're just like laughing at the Israelites as they're walking around, and then, you know, keep walking, for you won't knock down our wall. I'm not gonna sing the whole thing. That's not how it happened. That's not how it happened. No, the people of Jericho, they were not laughing, they were trembling. They're trembling because they're afraid that their gods might not be quite as strong as Israel's God, but not Rahab. Rahab doesn't hold on to her idols. No, she declares God's supremacy. What do I mean by supremacy? I mean that God is the one true God. God has no rivals. He depends on nothing. And he actively rules as the source, sustainer, and ultimate goal of the universe. God is supreme. Here's a few verses to go along with this definition of God's sovereignty on the screen for you here. Psalm 97 verse 9 says, "For you, O Lord, are most high over all the earth. You are exalted far above all gods." In 2026 language, God's the GOAT. God's the GOAT. He's got no rivals. There's no comparison. He is most high, exalted above everything else. God is supreme. He's got no rivals. Or the next verse for you here. Psalm 115, our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Nothing gets in the way of God doing what he wants. Me, I want to do something. There's about 100 things that get in my way. God, he wants to do something. Nothing is gonna stop him. God does all that he pleases. Or one more, Romans chapter 11, 4, from him and through him and to him are all things, to him be glory forever, amen. For from him, God is the source of all things, and through him, God is the sustainer of all things, and to him, God is the point or objective or goal of the universe. God is supreme. When Rahab declares God's supremacy in this verse, she is simultaneously surrendering all the false gods or idols in her life. See, it can be so easy in the Christian life to verbally declare God's supremacy, Jesus, your king, while at the same time we keep God's authority and supremacy away from certain parts of our lives. That's an idol. It can be easy to say, God, I declare your supremacy over my Sunday mornings. Every Sunday I come and I worship you. But if all that is happening is you're worshiping God on a Sunday morning, then God is not supreme in your life. You're just giving him a time slot in your calendar. No, declaring God's supremacy in your life means that there is no part of your life that God can't touch. There is no part of your life that God is not allowed to rule over. Like, God, I declare your supremacy. Just stay away from my kids. God, I declare your supremacy. Just stay away from my career. Like, that part's mine. God, I declare your supremacy. Just stay away from my finances. No, no, no. That's not declaring God's sovereignty. That is an idol. And so, God, my children, they're yours. My career, it's yours. My money, it's yours. My future, it's yours. My marriage, it's yours. My reputation, my expectations, my security, my friendships. God, there is no part of my life that I will keep you out of. I declare you as supreme over every part. I surrender it all. Forgive me when I hold on so tightly for the things that I think I want control over and I want to be supreme over. God, no, I declare you as supreme over it all. God, you can have it all. That's declaring God's supremacy. So question, what part of your life have you been keeping God out of? Giving God aspects of your life, but you're holding on so tightly to this one area. Friends, can I just encourage you with something? You and I make crappy gods. Like, God can do far more with that thing that you are holding on to than you ever can. And so we trust God's sovereignty and we declare his supremacy over every area of our life. We don't hold something back from him. Faith declares God's supremacy. Lastly, now look at verse 12. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them and deliver our lives from death. The men said to her, our life for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. Third aspect of faith that we see here in Rahab is this: faith hopes in God's salvation. Notice what happens here, right? This shady lady from the city, she declares Yahweh as sovereign and supreme, but then she doesn't stop there. She thinks, maybe this God will have mercy on me. Maybe Yahweh could be my God. Maybe this God could be a safe refuge for me. She's given up all control. She has thrown herself at the mercy seat of God, hoping in his salvation. And as the story would unfold, the spies tell her, hey, tie the scarlet cord around your window. And when we come in, we're gonna spare you and all who are in this house. So you just make sure you get your whole family in here and we're gonna protect you. As the story goes, the Israelites come in, the walls fall down, they conquer the city, and Rahab and her family find refuge, find salvation in God. Why? Because God delights to save those who turn to him in faith. Joshua 6 tells us, but Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day. Rahab hoped in God for her salvation and God delighted to save her. This third aspect of faith is crucial because there is a major difference between just believing in God and in hoping in God for salvation. Like, there's a big difference between acknowledging facts about God and placing faith in God for salvation. James 2, he writes this and he says, you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Like the argument he's making there is he's saying, hey, you believe the right things about God, so do the demons. Like, the demons know the right facts about God, but they ain't placing their hope in God for salvation. There's an old Presbyterian pastor named Theodore Kyler. He gives us a helpful illustration here to understand the difference. He says this: when a miner looks at the rope that is to lower him into the deep mine, he may say, I have faith in that rope. I think it's well made and strong. But when he lays hold of it and swings down into the tremendous chasm, then he is believing on the rope. Then he is trusting himself to the rope. It's not a mere opinion, it is an act. The miner lets go of everything else and bears his whole weight on those well-braided strands. Now that is faith. Faith hopes in the salvation of God. It's not merely a looking at God or appreciating the great facts about God, but it is a hoping in God for salvation, grabbing hold of God like that rope, taking the feet off the ledge and letting go of all else. It's not holding on to that rope, but then you have three other ropes as backup options. Like, faith with backup options is not faith. Okay, it is all in on this one thing. You know, it's not backup options in case this whole Jesus thing doesn't work out. It's not claiming to be Christian in front of certain friends, but then doing something completely different with another group of friends. Again, just it's kind of a backup option. Faith hopes in God's salvation. Now, you guys want to know the craziest part about Rahab's story? I love this so much. God so delights to save the lost. He so delights that when anyone turns to him in faith, he loved Rahab the prostitute so much that, get this, he didn't just welcome Rahab into the family of God. He didn't just put Rahab into the hall of faith. No, he went the extra mile and he put Rahab in the lineage of the Son of God who had come to save the world. If you read Matthew chapter 1, what you're going to read there is a lineage of Jesus Christ. And if you're going through the names, one of the names you're going to read is Rahab the prostitute. Why? Because God delights to save those who turn to him in faith. Roughly 1,400 years after Rahab, her descendant, Jesus is born to live the life you and I cannot live, to live the life that Rahab did not live, to pay the price of sin that you and I should have to pay, so that now all who call upon the name of the Lord will be saved by the grace of Jesus Christ. Rahab turned to God in faith, and God put her in the lineage of the one who would save any who turned to him in faith. Unlikely faith, unstoppable God. Have you placed your hope in God for salvation? I believe in God's sovereignty, that you're here for a reason. And I've been praying this week that just as God saved Rahab, that he would continue to demonstrate his saving power today. Have you placed your hope in Jesus Christ alone, letting go of all other ropes, no backup options, and hoping in Jesus alone for your salvation? I want to close our time with a third New Testament reference. I mentioned there's three times in the New Testament that it mentions Rahab by name. The third one is in the book of James, and James highlights an important aspect of faith that we didn't talk about yet. And if you know the book of James, then you know that the whole argument that James is making is this: faith takes action. Faith does not sit still. Again, faith is not appreciating God, but then not moving closer to God. Faith takes action. Faith moves. Faith does things. And so James mentions Rahab by name because he says Rahab demonstrated her faith when she hid the spies. She took an act. She did something. Her faith led her to take the action of hiding those spies. And then James says this, I believe it's on the screen for you. He says, "For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead." Genuine faith leads to action. And so my question for you at the end of this message is this: what is the one step of faith that God is asking you to take today? What is it? What is the one step action? What is the one step of faith that God is asking you to take today? Is it trusting in his sovereignty? Some of you, God has clearly been leading in a certain direction, but you've been fighting his sovereignty instead of trusting in it. Some of you need to take the step of faith of getting baptized. Some of you need the step of faith of having a conversation about vocational ministry. You've been fighting that for a long time, and it's time to take that leap of faith. Some of you, your step of faith today is just gonna be, I need prayer. It's just gonna be coming up to the front afterwards, or it's gonna be stopping the person before you leave the building. It's just gonna be, can I be prayed for? And maybe that's your step of faith today. Or is your step of faith declaring his supremacy? What's the one area in your life that you've been keeping God out of? Maybe that means you got to get something off your chest. Again, don't leave until you've done that. Because we declare, faith declares God's supremacy. We don't keep parts away from him. Or is it finally hoping in Jesus Christ for your salvation? Under God's sovereignty, again, I've been praying for this. I'm believing that he can and that he will. Hey, if God can save Rahab, he can save you. Like your past is not an excuse. It wasn't an excuse for Rahab. She forgot past so that she could focus faith in God. And if right now you're sitting here and you are fighting God's invitation to say, hey, come to Jesus Christ and be saved, it's not because you have faith, it's because you're just being filled with guilt of your past, of what you've done, and shame. Hey, that dies at the feet of Jesus. You bring that to Jesus. Your past is not an excuse. Would you place your hope in Jesus Christ for your salvation, because God delights to save those who turn to him in faith? Let me pray. God, you're so good. God, you're so good. Thank you for your word. Thank you for insights into your character. Thank you that you are a good God who is sovereign and good. And though there's times that we cannot trace your hand and figure out what on earth it is that you're doing, help us to trust your heart, that you're a good God who works all things for your glory and our good. God, I pray that there would be faith increased in this room right now. I pray, God, that you would get glory as we worship you right now. I pray that knees will bow at the feet of Jesus right now. I pray that every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And it's in your name I pray, amen.